The closest, I think the most that I learn, that I've learned from people, or that I've learned about emotion, what it is to be alive, has been through conversations where people share some of the deepest things that they've been through. And I think it's why, like, I write about this stuff, is it's so almost like I want to be able to make those connections and be able to listen and learn from others. And one way into that is to share my own experiences, just to sort of open that door to say that, this topic isn't off limits to me. And if you're somebody who also feels similarly, like, let's talk.
Welcome to Sema, a podcast on loss, grief, and healing. My name is C.L. Young, and in this episode, I talk with poet Ruchi Vyas. We spoke on one of the last days of 2020, me on a Sunday in the Northern Hemisphere, Ruchi on a Monday in the Southern Hemisphere. And I like to think of this conversation as being located squarely between the past and the future. Ruchi and I talk about writing and ritual as aspects of healing, and Ruchi's first book, When I Reach for Your Pulse, due out from Four Way Books in 2023, which orbits the experience of Ruchi finding his father dead from suicide in 2013. It's important to note that this episode explores some difficult topics, so please be careful with yourself when choosing to listen. Thank you for being here.
That question of why am I writing about this? Oh my gosh, that's just always there, right? Like, it's something that I can't get away from writing about, particularly my dad's suicide. Yet, my ultimate goal, I feel like, as a writer or in any art, is I want to make something that makes people feel listened to. I think it goes back to that thing about connection and conversation, and maybe even, like, those moments when people are sharing, doesn't necessarily have to be with related to death or trauma, but those moments when people have felt most alive, and the connection and tenderness that I feel in that moment, like, to me, I feel like that's life. And for the last decade of my life, I've really been wanting to, really imagining, like, what would it be like to live in that sort of space all the time? Not, one of grief necessarily, but one of aliveness, maybe like porosity to emotion, and to feeling. And I think, like, the poems that have moved me the most, the art that moves me the most, really, makes me feel seen, right? Or makes me feel understood in some way. And ultimately, I think it's like an impossibility that I'm always wanting to chase, is I want to write in a way where a reader feels like they have the space to then share their own story or enter into a conversation with someone in their life. Trying to push, conversation either deeper or into areas that are normally off limits, right? Because I think those boundaries we can put up, sometimes they're protective, but I think when it becomes our way of life with one another, then we're sort of closing off, and we're a mutualistic species that needs to connect with one another.
I started writing seriously to and not unknown to myself, yeah. really, to heal myself. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think by any means that writing books is a prescription yeah. I would yeah. write for somebody else. Yeah. And it's certainly not the only thing that has helped me move through difficult things. Of course, there's been millions of other things that have helped me with that. And I don't know what I would have done without it. And so I'm wondering how that functions for you. Like, what kind of role writing plays mm-hmm. in healing for you, or grieving, or just sort of how that has worked yeah. for you.
I think I want to get into a little bit of background, just because I came to writing sort of late, and as far as like formal training for writing, so I ended up going to medical school because of a lot of family pressure, you know, particularly from, you know, my father and my, you know, my mother really wanted it too, but she would have she understood ultimately when I left. But I was pretty, you know, I was skipping class, you know, I was getting by in medical school, just like cramming for exams, but I was checked out and I was reading a lot on my own. I was, you know, writing really crappy fiction. That's really what I was doing, just for fun. But all of it was obsessed with, you know, sort of questions of life and death and spirituality, what have you. Yeah. And then when I ended up taking that creative writing class, so I was working at the University of Michigan after I left medical school. And I audited a creative writing course that summer with Jessica Young, who's an amazing poet, and was my first teacher. And she was the first person who said, you know, and she said it in a much nicer way than this, but she said, you know, I think your fiction is so bad because you're trying to write poetry. Yeah.
You and me both,
Ruchi. Yeah, because I didn't really have any concern for narrative, but I had a lot of concern for the interiority of characters. And yeah, yeah. So I was writing a lot to sort of ask these questions, and a lot of that did have to do with growing up with my dad, who you know, had undiagnosed mental illness, was super high achieving, was a really great physician. I do think, you know, he loved me, my sister, my mother, but it was in an abusive way. And I think a lot of growing up with that, and also with a mom who is very philosophical, who is always studying Indian philosophy and Indian philosophical texts, I've always asked about, you know, life, death, and, you know, in Indian, you know, philosophy, you're not supposed to grieve, right? When somebody dies, it's not something to grieve. It's a natural part of life and death. And, you know, that's tied into the belief in reincarnation, that, you know, nothing really dies. We're just sort of recycling, right? So I've always been interested in these questions from a really young age. And I feel like, so then a year later, you know, my dad took his life. And then a year and a half after that is when I ended up starting my MFA. And really, I hadn't been thinking about an MFA or anything like that when my dad, before my dad died, or really immediately afterwards. But I do think subconsciously I was like displacing my energy into wanting to learn craft, just to keep my mind occupied in that way and to be able to ask these questions. So that's all a long way of saying, I don't know that I've consciously thought about I'm writing to heal, but I do think subconsciously it's always been a driver. It's to heal and to understand and to keep asking questions. For this book, I think like my process with it is it's been so focused on the poems. It's been so focused on me trying to figure out how to write poems. And, you know, it just so happened that, like, you know, the content that I've been obsessed with is, you know, my father's suicide, family upbringing, what do I do, you know, now that I carry this experience with me, right? Like that experience of my father's death, of finding him is with me always. So that's going to end up in the language and in the poems. And I think burrowing myself in craft, that was a sort of healing in a way too, because it was a way for me to look at things, you know, from different angles and not necessarily look at them head on like I can tend to do. It's sort of given me little slip screens into different angles of that experience and of thinking about life, thinking about death, thinking about family and lineage, inheritance, all of these sort of questions and what I want to do with them, how I want to live moving forward.
There's something too, to me, that I feel like poets are, in a way, we feel. It's not so much that we're writers, we're feelers, and we're feeling through these experiences of being alive and happen to have some facility with language. Or at least for me personally, I am just a feeling machine. It's my job to process and to articulate that processing so that someone else can read that articulation and it can help them a little bit with their life and their movement through feeling. Because I've found that, you know, and I think it's the same thing we were talking about, like to feel listened to or understood by a book or by a poem or something. It makes me feel like I can get through the world a little bit longer.
I was just on this camping trip with my partner, and, you know, we were having these great conversations on long walks. And on one of them, it was coming to that, because I've been having a little bit of an existential crisis over here. Like, what am I doing? You know, we've moved to New Zealand. I'm in this PhD with very little structure. And so just, okay, what is going on? And she sort of got out of me. What you're talking about, that I write not because I feel like I have to write and I love language so much, but because I think feeling and emotion is extremely important, and we need to, you know, value those things, and that is really what, to me, makes life. And maybe by writing about these things, like you said, it's not like it's a singular experience, right? Like, it's not unique to you. It's not unique to me, you know, losing someone from suicide or in any manner of ways. But how often do we really get, you know, a deep emotional, how long do we stay with that feeling, right? And not in a way that's oppressive, but to really like move through the textures of it and to try and better understand how those things move us and how those things end up living in us, because they certainly do, right? Like I can see it in people I know, that if you don't grapple with the emotion, it's going to be living with you one way or another. I do think it's important, just to write and to share. You know, for me, I think it's really come from an impulse that's like maybe more like very, not very thought through, just that ever since I found my dad, I've wanted to share the feeling of that with someone else, with other people. And it's an impossible thing, right? And so I think it keeps coming out in poems, because this is something I want to share, not because I want anybody to experience it, but I think there's something in the feeling and the emotion that had something to teach me, and maybe had something to teach me about Yeah, and I don't even know what it is, right? Like, I'm saying this right now, and it's not something I can communicate. I think I'm going to be writing about this for my whole life. You know, it's not going to go away.
Right. Right?
And I don't think that's a failure, right? I don't think that's like
no
something that's wrong. But I think that there's like the joy in grief too. I think that's part of what I hope, you know, that what part of what I wanted to express in the poems and in the writing is that it's a joy that's not, you know, happiness. It's not giddy. It's not like, you know, jumping up and down or anything like that. But it's maybe joy. I'm thinking about Ross Gay's Book of Delights and when he goes into that little defining delight and defining joy and all that. And I forget what those definitions are. But like right now I'm thinking about, you know, joy as that depth of feeling, right? And like living in that or being embodied in that depth of feeling and complexity of feeling, you know, emotions that are that don't really have a name, that we can't really name yet. New definition of blues. After Mississippi John Hurt. Does a stone-gifted movement give a damn about anything meaning anything? Would a sparrow, tired of singing the same song day after day, bark if given the choice? Like you, these are not questions for no reason. The breeze tastes rose milk. And the evening sounds, cars, leaves, friction, occasional passers-by, smooth into and out of the same drone. I'm all ears, a bag of tortellini filled with paneer, in the humid air warm as curdled milk, my shoulders loosen as a dog growls, as the sparrow stomps in a puddle before it flies to peck my shells. World, you have me. As long as wings unfurl and taunt, I'll keep scratching at the bark until I'm gone. We approach grief in such different ways because for you, it's almost like you're practiced at it. like you've encountered it so often, right?
Yeah.
Versus for me, it's like been, you know, less frequent, like at least directly, but like, you know, intense.
Yeah.
I often think about that, like what that's like for you, you know, encountering it again and again, and like what that's done, because like it is such a big part of your writing and your process, and it makes so much sense because of the frequency with which, you know, it's come up in your life.
Sure.
But
yeah, that's such an interesting way to put it, because it has been such a sort of insistent force in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Since I was, at least to young. Me personally, since I was like 12 or so.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that I've ever thought of it quite that way, but it is true, because it's been this sort of like every few years or so something will happen, and it's been, you know, varying proximities to me. Some of them, if they happened now, especially the ones when I was younger, high school age, junior high age, like if those happened to me now, they wouldn't affect me as much, I don't think, emotionally, because of what it having now been through closer and closer instances of loss. And so it's so funny. And I think this is the reason I write about it, really, because I think of people like you who've lost a parent, a family member, a partner, a sibling.
Yeah.
As the people who really have experienced grief, and like my grief or my instances of loss have all felt like they weren't somehow official or something, because they weren't in my family. And I think that's, and they were of friends and friends, a couple of them especially, who were very intimate friends. And so, and I think that has caused me to think more about like what defines family and what defines closeness, and thinking about closeness over time, and how changes in proximity over time don't necessarily lessen the significance of a person in your life.
When you were talking about how you maybe wouldn't be as emotionally affected, you know, now by by losses that might, you know, as you would have when they happened when you were younger. I think a lot about the idea of detachment, because in like Indian philosophy, it's a very nuanced thing, right? But I think like, you know, having been born and raised in the US, like detachment often seems like this sort of like cold thing, right? But I don't think it is, especially like when I was a kid and learned that things at home weren't, you know, the peaceful thing I thought they were, right? When I was like in middle school and started to learn like a lot of what my mom had to put up with, you know, and a lot of what my mom was dealing with abuse wise from my dad. I think then was really when I started to take meditation into consideration, and like these chants and things that my mom taught me, which were just like concepts and songs, but there was this sense of like, one, I always knew there was an option to sit and meditate. although I didn't really know what that meant, but I knew that it was supposed to mean like, you know, focusing your mind on one thing, or just letting, you know, thoughts go. And along with that, I think, one thing that's always taught, you know, in Indian philosophy is this idea of detachment, that, you know, loss will happen. And, you know, it's tied, you know, Hindu thought and Buddhist thought are like, you know, out of the same stuff, really, out of the same sort of community, different practices, offshoots from one another. But detachment, I think the word be like vairagya in Sanskrit, then it would be like dispassion and detachment, as a way of, I've always interpreted it as not, like you were saying, it's not a not feeling, it's not a way of avoiding feeling affection towards something or love towards something or someone, but as a way of acknowledging sort of the transitoriness of that attachment, and that there is no, you cannot control it. This is inevitable and it will keep going on, right? I don't know. Yeah, that's what I think about with detachment. And I feel that since that was a part of my spiritual practice, like I was almost like preparing for my dad's death for many, many years, even though I didn't think he was ever going to commit suicide. I didn't think it would happen when it did, but I thought so much. I was obsessed with thinking about death, and I was obsessed with asking those questions and about, you know, what is life, and, you know, how do you live with the detachment such that you don't get sort of overwhelmed by your own needs and passions when confronted with what other people need. Yeah, I think that's something I've always often thought about, is like, where does that, you know, when does love get overtaken by need? or, and when you bring some detachment into it, does that actually free you up to love more fully because you're not afraid of the loss? Because with my father, like I said, I think he loved us a lot, but he had no detachment in that. And what that did was led to sort of this fear-driven sort of love that was oppressive, you know, and just, yeah, yeah.
How do you feel like, it's so interesting because I feel like we have very similar trajectories in certain ways, but though coming mm-hmm. from very different directions. Like in undergrad, I studied philosophy, and I feel like I was obsessed with these questions from a very different angle that was very sort of, at least for a time, very anti-spiritual or anti-God or religion or something. Yeah. And I feel like the losses that I feel like I'm more spiritual than I've ever been in my entire life at this point. And I'm wondering how, like, it sounds like you had a pretty well-established spiritual life and practice before your dad died. And I'm wondering how that has changed or augmented or, you know, evolved since then, if at all.
So, yeah, I think, like, growing up, yeah, my mom really instilled in me these, like, Sanskrit shlokas and prayers and songs that are, you know, it's probably, I haven't really sat down and recorded all of them, but like, I think, you know, what I've memorized, like, you know, it's like 45 minutes, an hour's worth of these songs that, you know, she never taught me the meaning of, but which I knew like a little bit of like what they symbolized. And what that gave me the freedom to do was sort of almost detach it from the religious, like the fundamental religious context, right? Or like the worshipfulness and more to create my own like symbology out of these inherited songs. I think, you know, since I was about 20, I've pretty much meditated in some form every day. And I think what that's allowed is definitely, I guess maybe a grounding in detachment, or maybe detachment is the wrong word, and it's acceptance, just like things are what they are and not like don't work to change them or don't bring attention to things, but also don't, they're in the Bhagavad Gita, which is, you know, one of the main texts that I grew up with and that, you know, my mom has studied a lot. There's the idea of karma yoga, which is sort of like a path to salvation, which is just through action, where you're not concerned with the fruits of the action. So doing action for the sake of the action, action itself. Just not being so concerned with what the end result is. And I think that's been something that's always been really helpful for me. I mean, when my dad died, so I found him in, you know, my childhood basement. And then 10 days later, I was back in the house. And I realized this fear, you know, of just, I was terrified to go down there again. And because of that, I decided to go in, and I went down to the basement. I sat under where I found him, and I meditated for about, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And I think that is another thing, like from the spiritual practice of and meditating and sitting in discomfort has born out of it. Like what I've cultivated out of that is when I sense that discomfort to sort of go into it, not to shy away from it, to trust that, like maybe you were saying, like, I'll be okay, I can do this, and it's better to face the thing.
Yep.
And listen and confront. Yeah, and since then, it's a good question. I know that it's morphed and that it morphs subtly, but as far as like my main worldview or like practice since my dad died, I think it's become more complex because I've thought more about social issues. I've thought more, I think up until, you know, my early mid-20s, I was pretty sheltered and I didn't really engage as much with like social justice thinking beyond like surface level. And I've thought a lot more about power and privilege, which I think has deepened that spiritual practice in a way that it's complicated it. And it's made me really grapple with, you know, like Sanskrit and the language in which I've sort of like meditated and taught through these things is also tied up with caste in India. It's tied up with a lot of these other, you know, and right now in India, there's a lot of the president is a fundamentalist who is causing a lot of damage and hurting a lot of people. So I think it hasn't really been directly related to my dad, but in a way it has been, because a lot of my writing is thinking about the power and privilege, especially as a man in the Indian community that my dad had that enabled him to get away with the abuses that he got away with for so long, and realizing that me as a man in that community, if I don't do the work, I could get away with those things too. And I think my spiritual practice has sort of gotten complicated in that way, in that I'm not just blindly like idealizing these inherited thoughts, but I'm really grappling with them more and more.
Yeah. Do you want to talk at all about the rituals that you're doing?
So for my PhD here, it's a totally self-directed PhD. And I wanted to think about essentially what I was just talking about is putting this spiritual practice, which is really important to me and I think has, you know, helped cultivate the person I am, who values listening, who values emotion and feeling. But to complicate that by thinking about legacies of colonialism, legacies of violence, patriarchy that live inside that, right? Or, you know, what has enabled me to practice these spiritual practices in such an insulated way? So I'm doing these rituals once a week. There are three different rituals, and essentially I'm incorporating one of those Sanskrit chants or a piece of Sanskrit text. I'm incorporating poems in English that I've memorized from, you know, these are different poets that I've, you know, loved growing up or poets that I'm encountering now. And sort of using these memorized texts to frame ritualized action. And some of those actions are sacrilegious, like there's this religious thread that I had to do a ceremony for when I was a teenager, that Brahmins are supposed to wear, that signifies that you've entered the student phase of life, you're the student and working phase of life. And I've been ritually cutting it, using it to tie myself to some sort of colonial implement which has been like the Oxford Annotated Bible I have, or the Norton Anthology of Poetry. I've been ritually cutting it. So that's, I don't think my mom's very happy about that, but, sure. I think that's one way that I'm trying to interrogate the power while still keeping alive the chants, you know, and the thought and, you know, meditative practice behind, that tradition. Another ritual is interrogating my lack of relationship to the non-human, I think, especially growing up indoors a lot. My family wasn't really outdoors types. And so I'm asking a plant if I can hold it, and holding the plant while I whisper a mantra to it over and over. And the third one is, and this one, I'm excited to talk to you about, Katie, too, because it's the dance one, where I'm thinking about how I've really, you know, as sort of as a cis man who's, you know, came from like growing up, I was very much I would say I'm like a recovering bro in many ways, right? You know, like all my friends from growing up, pretty much all we talk about is sports and, you know, drinking beer, that sort of thing. But I thinking about how I really restricted the way I move, and comported myself to sort of, you know, I'd say white colonial standards in many ways to assimilate. And so, moving just like dancing to weird jazz music in public spaces, again, while keeping these sort of chants as part of the ritual. So,
how does it feel in your body?
It feels really great. I think I've done a good job of just trying to block out what people think and just listening to the body and just moving in whatever weird flailing way it wants to. And so that's it. Whenever I do it, it's been really healing. And I think I still notice there's a resistance to wanting to do it. Like actually this morning I was going to do it, but then I just didn't.
Yeah.
Right. There's still sort of a fear around exposing the body. But I'll get back to you too, because my plan is in the new year to really, you know, push myself a bit to do it in more public spaces.
I could talk to you for like 12 more hours.
I know, ditto, but we should.
I know. We should find an end point. Yeah. Do you have gotten yourself to a place where you feel you can heal some of that relationship on your end, or how does that feel for you?
No, I think I can. I feel like and part of it is the writing, and writing through it has really helped me feel an understanding about him and why he was the way he was, and that it probably came from a cycle of abuse, you know, in a way. And maybe it goes back to the meditative thing. It's like, I almost, you know, my father's a different, I believe that everything, you know, non-human and human is sort of like different aspects of, you know, a self, right? Of whatever we are. And so in a way, like, my father is an aspect of myself that, you know, I can acknowledge, like, it wasn't like his behavior came from an evil place. It was just layered and complex. And I guess with the spirituality thing, like, I don't know if I believe in reincarnation or not, but I do take comfort in, like, you know, I do believe that energy that was with him is going to go on into something else, somewhere else. And he'll keep working through whatever it is he was working through.
Yeah, I wonder what healing really is when it comes to relationships with other people. I mean, I think if it's real to a person, then it's real, you know? And so totally. That's what matters. But
I think, you know, one thing that like you said, like I'll never be able to fix that relationship, right? Or I'll never be able to like go back and be like, okay, now I feel good about how I was with my dad and how we were with each other, right? But I think one thing that I learned from him and from our relationship is sort of patience. And, you know, and part of this comes from my mom too. It's just like patience and a deep love for, you know, even those people who are most difficult, right? Like that is something I want to aspire to. And I think like through that relationship with my dad and, you know, how it ended, it's like, how can I bring love into that now?
Thank you for listening to Sema. Initiated in 2018 as a reading and workshop series in Boise, Idaho, Sema aspires to nurture deep attention and connection as means for change. To join the mailing list or share your insights, please email sema.readingseries@gmail.com. The song in the background is by Teal Gardner. You can find a link to more of her music in the notes.